Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris. You're watching Consider This. Joining me on the show tonight, I have Dr. Ross Tapsell, Director of the Australian National University's Malaysia Institute, which is based in Canberra. Now, he was in town recently to give a workshop on the impact of social media in Southeast Asia, looking at rising trends within the region. And he joins us tonight to discuss a little bit more about the situation here in Malaysia. Welcome, Ross.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you on the show. Now, I kind of want to touch very broadly first on the issue of misinformation first, right? Or fake news, as most people call it. Ever since the term came into public consciousness, I would say around the time President Trump got into office in the US, about 2016 or so, it's been a few years now, and it's become a part of our lexicon. Almost everyone understands what so-called fake news means or seems to represent. But what do you think about the substance of that conversation? Do we truly understand how it impacts our lives and how it's spread? Has the conversation progressed far enough, in your opinion, Ross?
Yeah, it's a really good point. Fake news, I think, was the Oxford Dictionary's word of the year in 2016. But since that time, politicians and many journalists and the mainstream media are often talking about fake news this and fake news that, but what exactly does fake news mean? And it might sound a little bit boring to sort of define this and to talk about definitions, but it is really important to talk about what is fake news and what isn't.
Right.
And one of the problems that we saw in Malaysia, of course, was in that previous law, which was created by the previous government, and the anti-fake news bill was, you know, how fake news was defined, being really vague as news which is fake or false. Well, what exactly does that mean? So it is really important to have some of these terms in our lexicon as we describe them. Misinformation, which is where it's sort of misleading but perhaps not deliberate.
Okay.
Disinformation, which is clearly deliberate, usually by syndicates or paid companies putting out fake, false disinformation. And just bad journalism, which is often what politicians complain about when they talk about fake news.
Okay. All right. Well, there's also the element of social media, right? And I'm wondering whether falling under the category of disinformation, there seems to be, according to the Oxford Internet Institute, last year's report said that organized social media manipulation has more than doubled since 2017. And they found that 70 countries now are using computational propaganda to manipulate public opinion. Talk to me a little bit about that, how social media tends to empower propaganda and disinformation in really new ways that we're struggling to understand now.
Yeah, right. Or that the majority of the public would think about as just cyber troopers in Malaysia, trolls in the Philippines, buzzers, I think they're more likely called in Indonesia. Again, defining them can be really hard too. Are we talking about computational propaganda, which is where Twitter bots are created by computer scientists in, say, the Ukraine or Russia or China or indeed locally? Or are we talking about teams of, say, young university students who are given money to put out stuff on social media, which is largely disinformation practices? And I've been researching that in the Philippines, in Indonesia, and for quite some time in Malaysia, because the cyber trooper phenomenon has been around for quite some time, right, in Malaysia.
Is there a similarity between these three different countries that you talked about? I mean, is the Malaysian situation with the, say, cyber troopers similar to that of the Philippines, for instance?
There's a lot of similarities. They're often connected to elections, and they're often paid by politicians, political parties, or connections to those political parties. Obviously, in the Philippines, it's been well documented that President Duterte has had link, and that Oxford report you referred to talked about links from the trolls to being pro Duterte in their messages that they were pumping out. Of course, there's been a lot of debate here in Malaysia about BN cyber troopers and various other political actors who are involved in this. But it's certainly a rising trend. They're right to say that. The latest trend, by the way, is on Instagram, of course.
On Instagram?
Yeah.
What kind of disinformation is on Instagram?
Well, or at least click farming is the term used now for Instagram, where you pay young people, usually students or underemployed people, to go on Instagram and click a lot of likes to promote your product. And that could be political, or it could be business, or it could be other forms of Instagram celebrity type thing. But that's what's happening on social media. You want to raise your profile, you can pay people that will do that.
Right. So, okay. So let's take a look at the election related element of this. You talked a little bit about that, right? It may seem, I guess, common sense, but why is it that this almost always ratchets up during election campaigns?
Yeah.
What is it about election campaigns that makes this such fertile ground for disinformation to spread?
Right, and in Southeast Asia in particular, largely because of usage. I mean, so many people are engaged on social media platforms here in Southeast Asia. Malaysia, of course, a lot of young people under the age of 35 are using social media on a daily basis, sometimes 5 hours a day on social media platforms, which means, of course, political groups and PR companies are now selling their expertise as a way to try and win votes through promoting their candidates' product on social media. Of course, in Malaysia, there's even a more local context where the now government previous opposition was really good at social media campaigning because they had to be, because the mainstream media often did not report them more as widely as they did the government. So they had to use social media to get their messages out.
When you say social media, Ross, what kind of social? You talked about Instagram. Are you talking about like Facebook and Twitter? Is that the platforms that are used?
Right. It depends a bit on the country. Facebook, of course, is the most used, and Facebook is really where most of the action is. Mm. And that can involve around geolocating certain and targeting certain voters in certain areas, because you can use Facebook data to figure out who they might vote for. In some cases, as I've interviewed some of these people in the Philippines, they're creating fake Facebook accounts in order to put out certain types of information about the candidate. So we're seeing some of that happening now as disinformation producers. In Twitter, it's mostly bots trying to manipulate hashtags. So increasingly, when you see a hashtag that is trending on Twitter, often, you know, skeptically, I will think, oh, that's driven by bots or driven by cyber troopers or trolls on Twitter. But that's how you try and get your conversation out on social media and Twitter.
Can you break it down for us? I mean, let's use an example of an election campaign, right? Uh-huh. So what happens? I'm trying to think of it as, you know, an environment where there's pollution and it's kind of noise pollution. Uh-huh. And the more you add to this conversation, it becomes even more polluted. Is that how it works to kind of muddy the waters? Is that how disinformation works? Or is it direct, fake information about a certain candidate, fake information about a certain situation, or, you know, for instance, we were talking before this, and this is not an election example, but we were talking about the fires in Australia, and you had mentioned that there was a lot of fake news or disinformation out there about it being arsonists who started it. Is that how disinformation works, that it's to confuse rather, or to be false? Explain it to me, please.
Yeah, so there's a number of ways this could work. Maybe if I start talking about election period, gives you a sense of why this is rising. I guess the first thing to think about is that if you are running for politics, if you're a political candidate, you need to have a social media strategy in the digital era.
Right.
So that would involve hiring a PR company or hiring people who are experts on social media. And they might be just working on your Facebook page or your Twitter profile. But at some point, you've got to think about a black campaign or a negative campaign against you. And how would you counter that negative campaign? Which often means you've got to have a team of people who will counter a black campaign against you. And often those teams of people end up putting out negative campaigning about their opponent. And then it can really, as one candidate, as one campaigner told me, In the US, Michelle Obama said, when they go high, when they go low, we go high. But here, when they go low, we go lower.
Even lower.
So that's how it works in an election, sort of disinformation or election negative campaigning in the digital era.
Okay.
The other issue might be around sort of how a certain event or an issue is discussed on social media. And that's when you see manipulation of hashtags. So in the Australian context, certain groups or fossil fuel companies, for example, might want to push the idea that the fires are caused not by climate change, but in fact by individual arsonists, okay. And they're the people we need to crack down on.
All right. Okay, we're going to come back a little bit and continue this conversation about misinformation, disinformation and fake news, touching on regulation. Don't go anywhere. Stay with us right here on Consider This. Welcome back to Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me, Dr. Ross Tapsell from Australian National University's Malaysia Institute. Now, I want to touch a little bit about the Anti-Fake News Act or law, as you pointed out a little bit earlier. It's been repealed, so kudos to the current government for doing that. However, now there's perhaps talk about another type of law to take a look at false information. Currently, the Malaysian Media Council has just elected its pro tem committee. Now, social media would fall under them, right? Any abuses in social media, would that fall under the Media Council?
I presume not.
Okay.
I mean, you could describe more. But usually a Media Council is looking at mainstream media work.
At journalists.
And then we think elsewhere about social media.
So where would the misuse of social media, for instance, fall under? For Malaysia, it would be under the MCMC, but do you think there needs to be perhaps laws that look at this, regulation that looks at abuse of social media?
There's certainly pressure, I think, on the government and the minister to do something in this space and create some kind of either regulation or commission or overarching body. And I can understand that, especially given we've just discussed some of this disinformation practices that are rising.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, when new laws have been created, first in Malaysia, now repealed, but also elsewhere in Southeast Asia, we've seen them being politicized or in some cases abused, and in some cases cracked down on individual citizens who share material that they either didn't know was fake because they're very uneducated, or really is cracking down on one or two specific individuals really how a society should work.
Okay.
And so there's questions around whether a regulation is a good thing. So the big question is, how do you try to reduce disinformation without bringing in a draconian law? And Malaysian government, I think, understands that. I think the Minister of Communication and others understand that they don't want to bring in a draconian law as we're seeing in other parts of Southeast Asia.
Mm.
So the question is, well, then what does need to be sort of cracked down upon? And I think the important thing here is that cracking down on syndicates, you know, business companies, groups who are paid and are creating this stuff for a profit, rather than individuals who are sharing material just on their own social media pages, is a better way to try to crack down on some of this disinformation practices.
So we know in Singapore that there is this law that's being used, and you know, I'm wondering, so we've got Singapore as an example. Are there any other examples of, say, countries who are perhaps getting it right on the regulation front?
Getting it right. Yeah.
So we've got Singapore as an example
right. Of
how, you know, you can have draconian regulation.
Yeah.
What examples should we be looking at if we were looking to model for a model?
Yeah, Germany and France, the Europeans are trying to have a model where they're looking to find platforms and trying to put the responsibility back onto the platforms.
Okay.
And I think, you know, that's something worth thinking about, to try to say to Facebook and Twitter, you guys need to do this better, otherwise we will fine you.
Mm.
And from my interviews with disinformation producers in Southeast Asia, what scares them most is actually platform takedowns. So yes, there's fact checkers and But they're more worried about the fact that Facebook takes down all the pages they've created or names them as bad actors or, as Facebook likes to call it, inauthentic behaviour. So, you know, this is what the responsibility, I think, does need to fall back on the platforms, but perhaps government can work harder in making that happen.
So explain a little bit about that. So the biggest fear is that these platforms would act on them. How would you know, Facebook and Google, for instance, act on these so-called bad actors? How do they identify these bad actors?
Right, so they identify it through inauthentic behaviour, which is usually they're creating fake Facebook accounts, they're creating networks which pump out the same kind of material, or social media pages that are just copying and pasting stuff in the same news sites, for example, throughout the Malaysian media or on individual politicians' pages. So it's the inauthentic behaviour that they're cracking down on. In Twitter, this can mean bots and trolls. But unfortunately, a lot of this stuff has been exposed by researchers themselves, including international and local researchers.
Okay.
And the responsibility needs to be more adopted by Twitter and Facebook and Google, because they're the ones that have the genius computer scientists and the billion-dollar companies that can actually take down this inauthentic behaviour. And so they have tried to do this more often in recent times. They've named and shamed bad actors. But I think they need to do much more of it.
I want to talk a little bit about how, you know, the disinformation from, say, those bad actors trickles down into the public consciousness, how it becomes trumpeted perhaps through journalists like myself, through the media, right? So when the media unintentionally reports disinformation and how that becomes, then the message becomes amplified. Has that been the case that you've noticed at all?
Oh, I think there's definite, I mean, one of the best ways to reduce fake news, reduce disinformation, is to just have better quality journalism. If we can again talk about Australia and the fire situation at the moment, the national broadcaster, the ABC, has been lauded by Australian citizens for the excellent reportage and the excellent coverage that they've been doing on the fires. And so there's a lot of trust in the national broadcaster, in the ABC. When fires are coming or when there's hail or when there's issues to be discussed and events are breaking, people turn to our national public broadcaster because they're seen as reliable journalists and a reliable news site. In Southeast Asia, that's more difficult, right? Trust in the state broadcasters is much lower. They're generally seen to be pro-government or pumping out government messages. Media can be very much tied to ownership, in the case of Indonesia in particular, which means that trust is being reduced.
Sure.
So in order to reduce fake news, you've got to have true news, and people have to believe that news is true. So improving quality journalism is so important.
Is that the first step? Because I'm just wondering, you know, the trust deficit is there undeniably, and how do you bridge that trust deficit if you can't get, say, eyes on pages because the distrust is there?
Yeah, it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, isn't it? And especially as people move away from mainstream media and go to Facebook pages that they either agree with, or that gets them angry, or it breaches racial and religious echo chambers, as we call them, then that becomes very hard. It's not a simple issue, that's for sure.
All right, okay, let's continue this shortly on Consider This. Don't go anywhere. Thank you for staying with us on Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me tonight is Ross Tapsell from ANU's Malaysia Institute. Now, I want to talk, Ross, a little bit about the rise of WhatsApp as a primary vector for disinformation and misinformation as well. Malaysians, we love our WhatsApp groups. That seems to be the way we get our news, our information, and what's for dinner as well. So how have you seen in your research WhatsApp being adopted?
Yeah, really culturally specific in a lot of ways, but also, of course, WhatsApp is growing as a platform globally. I mean, I've spent time in Southeast Asian villages. It's interesting in the pre-digital era. It's interesting to think about how information was passed around, and often a lot of it was gossip, and you know, my friend said this, and part of it was about being a good citizen, just passing on information, even if you weren't sure it was 100% true, particularly for older generations, you know, sitting around in a kampung and talking a bit of gossip, and I heard this and I heard that, and my uncle's brother's auntie's sister said this. And I think in a lot of ways it's just now moved online. You know, parents, young people are always telling me, students are always telling me, oh, my uncle or my aunt or my parents are always sharing this stuff. I think part of it is just sort of being a good citizen in a rapidly evolving information society.
It's almost a tribal thing, right? We want to communicate with our tribe. What do you tell your students or young people who come up to you and say, well, in my family WhatsApp group, I've got an uncle who's always sending me all these dubious messages. What do you tell them?
Well, the interesting thing to ask someone's uncle there would be, what do you use the internet for? And interestingly, in Southeast Asia, a lot of older generation of people are just getting their first smartphone for the first time in their life at the age of 50 or 40s, 60s. And they're really only using it for two things, and that would be WhatsApp and increasingly Facebook. And a lot of that is just about communicating with their local people and family who are, you know, outside of their kampung or area. So it's easy, I guess, for younger people to be critical, but they often use their smartphone for a whole range of platforms. While the people who are what we might call on the digital divide, as in they have internet access, but they don't have access to a vast array of what the internet offers, which is why, by the way, I'm generally against Facebook's free basics, because it encourages citizens to stay on Facebook because it's free and not go to other parts of the internet. And I think the more access people have to the internet and the faster that access is, the more likely they are to get a whole range of information.
Okay. Well, Ross, it seems to me that you've got the digital natives, right? You've got the young people who seem to know how to verify or feels, I guess, they have this innate suspicion of whatever they see, they want to check whether it's true. There's a little bit more skepticism there. How are you talking to perhaps a different generation who, as you mentioned, are dealing with, you know, the idea of fake news and misinformation for the first time? What are you telling them? How are you telling them to respond to these types of disinformation fueled messages?
Right. And this is where we go into the fields, I guess, of digital literacy programs or media literacy programs.
Does that work, Ross?
I think they're being adopted now. And I think there's a number of NGOs and fact-checking organizations and indeed governments who are trying to improve digital literacy in Southeast Asia. And that's really important, right?
Who are they targeting?
People who the people I discussed before about people who are getting smartphones for the first time.
Okay.
Schools, of course, but unfortunately, you're still not, you know, it needs to be much more adopted in schools. Universities have digital literacy programs, but they're more, you know, literate people who are more higher educated. So there's Indonesia has like car-free days where they talk about hoax news being a problem. I mean, these things do help. So people can now, people now talk about hoax news more than they used to, so they know it's there. But yeah, digital literacy and media literacy is really interesting. I think for the younger generation, we used to teach media literacy around you have to be careful about who might be manipulating the media, owners, governments, journalists, whatever. Now I think we need to educate young people about what is good journalism, because young people are very much skeptical of the media. Oh, don't watch this channel for this reason, or don't believe that newspaper because that's pro this or that. And in fact, we need to say, well, okay, what journalism can you rely upon? What is quality information that you can get? Because the more we say, oh, you have to be skeptical of everything that you receive, then people just tend to move towards media that they agree with.
Right, and it just confirms their worldview. All right, well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have on the show tonight. Ross, thank you so much for joining me and sharing insights into this. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thanks for having me,
thank
Melissa.
Thank you. I'm Melissa Idris, signing off for tonight on Consider This. I'll be back with another episode tomorrow, same time. I'll see you then. Good night. Thanks, Ross.
Cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Done.